Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about texting do's and don'ts, more specifically, to punctuate or not to punctuate. And the answer may rest on what year you were born. Because it turns out, for Gen Z, a period at the end of a sentence is just a passive-aggressive end of a sentence. Here to clue us in on the latest texting rules is Miami University professor Megan Gerhart, who teaches management and leadership at the Farmer School of Business in Oxford. She's also the author of Gentelligence, a revolutionary approach to leading an intergenerational workforce. A past article she wrote ignited quite the conversation in the social media universe and more recently here in our newsroom. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Gerhart.
Thank you so much, Amy.
So if I responded to someone from Gen Z with a okay, like O-K-A-Y, and ended it with a period, how would they perceive my tone in that text?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think that that would probably be perceived as a little bit passive aggressive of you. So there's a lot of sort of subtleties that I did not certainly realize as a 48-year-old existed in what I thought were pretty innocent responses to things. But I'm learning quickly that there's many things to navigate there.
So why has punctuation been eradicated in many text messages, especially from younger texting users? Why no punctuation?
So I discovered this. Some of my students here at the university were doing a project for me on generational differences in communication in the workplace. And they just sort of threw in as an afterthought that example you mentioned about not ending your text with a period because it would be very harsh. And so I went digging. I think the best way I can summarize it is this is a generation that often, you know, many of them learn to text before they learn to formally write. And the intel I've gotten is basically that to many in Gen Z, texting is more of a conversation than a written exchange. And when you do something like end a text with a period, to them, it's bringing an air of formality. It translates into something similar to we need to talk. So sort of like wearing a suit to a picnic. You just made something serious that's meant to be very informal. Of course, those of us who didn't grow up in the age of texting at a young age, we're just over here being professional using our grammar and thinking that that's the correct way to write a sentence. And we're getting some wires crossed there, I think, without realizing it.
Yes. I mean, and over the years, you know, everyone has come to realize that in texting, you know, like you don't have to write hello or hi, it's me, mom. You know, obviously they know. But I feel like at the beginning of texting, people were doing that. But I just feel like putting periods in throughout, if the text has multiple sentences, throwing in a period and a question mark, I'm not trying to be passive aggressive. I'm just trying to make sure you can understand what I mean. Right.
Correct. And so what's really interesting, so you mentioned the name of my book, Gentelligence. So Gentelligence is just about it's not about stereotyping. It's not about insisting that everyone in a generation does or acts exactly the same, of course. It's about having smarter intergenerational conversations. So as silly as this topic seems to a lot of people, as you said, it has been very sticky because you cannot unsee it. I do a lot of talks and keynotes. And when I mention this as an example of getting our wires crossed, where my 23-year-old team member might be, you know, interpreting my text that I thought was very professional as her boss as being, you know, cranky or I'm upset about something or we need to have a discussion when in fact I thought I was being a professional adult. And so it's a two-way street. You know, it's not that I shouldn't use punctuation in my text because that's the norm that is comfortable to me. But I should probably be aware that it might be interpreted differently by somebody who has a very different lens and different norms. And the same way I said to her, well, if the person texting you is my age or older, we're not mad, we're just punctuating. And so it is kind of a tip of the iceberg, Amy. So one of the things that this led to was, as you said, the reason that many younger people send multiple short texts is they're not relying on the same kind of punctuation we might be. My text might be a little bit more like a paragraph, but also, like, fun fact, there was a time when you were charged by the text message. I don't know if you remember that, but I certainly
I
remember
do indeed,
that.
So yes.
It's a little ingrained in us. Like, let's get the most for our bang for our buck here. But also led to something you mentioned in your initial email to me, which is, This also gives us insight as to why emojis and things like LOL or ha 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 are used more often by younger generations at the end of a sentence, which doesn't make as much sense to me when I'm getting a professional email that ends with, ha ha ha. That is very confusing to me. I'm like, what is funny? What are we laughing about? But I've actually gone digging. This is not the contribution I thought I would make to society, just to be clear, but this seems to be very interesting to people. And I've gone digging, always fascinated as to what's going on there and why. So the emojis, the exclamation points, the LOLs, the ha ha ha's, that's kind of the new piece of this that I've been digging into the last week or so.
I've seen many. I'm a older millennial. I think some people call me a geriatric millennial, right? And
No
I've
problem.
seen,
Yes.
yes, I'm an older millennial. And I've seen many memes on Instagram where one sees all their videos and such, about millennials feel the need to soften the blow of communication by adding a ha-ha at the end or a smiley face or an LOL. Like, and my sister and I talked about it. She's an LOLer. She writes LOL and I write ha-ha. And it's just like what we do. Why do we do that? Why do I feel the need to soften anything?
Well, and that's so interesting because I don't have that need, and I'm a Gen Xer, but younger Gen Xer, so only like probably a few years separating us, but here we sit with this very interesting subtle difference. So based on what I've, and again, just want to be clear, this is kind of the result of just trying to understand, well, why is that? Not right or wrong, but if I'm reading your ha ha as unprofessional. I've had a lot of younger former students of mine say, well, my boss is telling me I need to be more professional when I text. I don't, what is not professional about, right? And so it's very much a lens issue. If I'm looking at that and thinking that's too casual for work, and you're thinking I'm being grumpy because I'm over here with my semicolon and my period, then it seems like a tip of the iceberg issue, but it's a communication is everywhere. And if we're misinterpreting each other on that, what else are we missing? So I think the thing about softening is fascinating because here we have, a generation that maybe is hyper-focused on the fact that a lot of their streams of communication lack context. So they're very aware that there's a chance somebody might read that text wrong. So they want to provide some cues like just being lighthearted, definitely mean no offense, just take it for what it is, like trying to almost get ahead of the fact that that might be read in a way that wouldn't be good. And I want to make sure that doesn't happen. So here's my emoji, here's my ha ha. Something I uncovered, again, stop the presses, is I was back on Instagram, as you said, the all source of not scientific info, but just, sort of initial input. And I said, tell me about the LOL, the ha ha ha, the emoji. Like, what are you using it for when you're using it? And I was told immediately that LOL capitalized is very different than LOL undercase.
Indeed, I
So there's
agree.
yet
Yeah.
another,
Yeah, there's more layers.
I did not, this is not something I was aware of, right? And so here I am, like, just depending on if the caps lock is on. I don't know that I actually ever use LOL, to be fair, but that's different. Ha is different than ha ha. And I get the question a lot. Like I will tell you, most people my age or older, when I bring this up as a sort of fun, sticky example of how we may be seeing things very differently based on generation without realizing it. A large portion of the older generation, myself included, sort of initially says, "Are you kidding me right now? Like, really?" But the reason I think it's important, I worked with a manager who, after we had this discussion in a workshop, he just reached out to his team and said, "Is this true?" Which is what I want. I want people to, I don't, I'm not telling you how to text, you do you, but just opening that conversation of saying, "Is this true?" And then this floodgate comes in, where in his case, his team was like, "Yes, like you are the grumpy manager who's sending the grumpy texts." And he was a very jovial, fun guy. And he's like, "I am not grumpy. I am fun." Right. And so he told me what he did is he started sending voice memos instead of texts to his team because he's like, if they're interpreting that as grouchy, like that wasn't. And this is the experience I had with my 23-year-old team member in Gentelligence, my organization. She said, "I just thought you were upset with me a lot." And we work remotely. So I didn't have the ability to like obviously clear that up and had no idea. So I always say you don't have to stop punctuating, or on the other side, people don't have to change the way that they're communicating. But the awareness, right, that I'm gonna try to remember when I'm texting somebody in that age group that it could be read differently than I intended, and they should remember that I'm not mad, I'm just punctuating. So it is quite interesting, sort of the norms we learn and how they evolve over time. Certainly our communication norms now are quite different than they were, 50 years ago. But I think it's really interesting to watch them kind of evolve under our feet.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and it's Tech Tuesday. And on the show, we're talking about intergenerational texting do's and don'ts with Miami University professor Megan Gerhart. She teaches management and leadership at the Farmer School of Business in Oxford and has written about this topic. You mentioned earlier about capitalized versus lowercase. A lot of Gen Z has switched off their auto-capitalization on their text messaging, and there's a trend of no capitalization common amongst younger girls. They call themselves the lowercase girls. Have you heard of this?
I have not. This is hot off the
Yeah.
press, Amy. I'll
Oh.
have to get into this.
Well, one of my Gen Z student producers found a very interesting article where about people calling themselves the lowercase girls. You should definitely look it up. But yeah, so what the idea is that Gen Z is switching off the auto capitalization so that autocorrect doesn't capitalize anything for them. They want it all lowercase.
Well, and what's so funny is when I first happened upon this, and I always try to decide, I'm an academic, I'm a consultant, I like to keep things like, let's do some smart conversation. It took me a minute to decide, like, is this one of those fluffy things that I don't want to touch? And then when I realized, like, no, it really is causing people to have misunderstandings. It's so interesting, though. My husband said when I explained to him this phenomenon that I had happened upon, he's like, can they do that? I said, what? He said, just like decide to get rid of grammar. Like you can't do that, right? But our norms around language and communication do change. But I think what's really important is, so if you are, let's just put ourselves in the shoes of a younger person who's communicating with someone older, let's say. You probably don't want your texting interpreted as unprofessional. Like that person doesn't even know how to use a capital letter, or that person keeps throwing in all these emojis when we're having a professional workplace exchange. The intent of the younger person isn't to be unprofessional. It's a norm that they use all the time. But it's about knowing your audience, right? So it's like there might be a time when switching back on the caps lock is going to be a thing you consciously decide to do when you're not texting your friends, you're texting your boss or your teammate. And same on my side, like if I'm texting my students or my younger team members, I cannot unsee it. So I very frequently now just don't punctuate with a period because I realize that that could be read differently. So I think you're fine to do it with people similar in age to you when you feel like these are our norms, we all get it. I think it's when we're trying to create an intergenerational dynamic where I don't want to be misinterpreted. I always say generations are like cross-cultural relations. When we travel, of course we have our own norms that are comfortable to us, but we're much more aware we might be misunderstood when we travel to a different culture. So we work harder to make sure that doesn't happen. And so I really, all the work I do is about trying to make sure people try to bring that awareness into their cross-generational communications, whether it's with your kids or, your teammates at work, or vice versa. Just kind of understanding that, like, no capital letters or emojis, or on my side, the ellipsis, that sort of thing is associated with people my age. Like just being aware that it might be interpreted differently, I think is a step in the right direction for sure.
Yeah, the members of Gen Z in our newsroom that I talked with about this with basically said that they are aware. They use completely different styles whenever they are texting someone. It depends on who it is, if it's their boss or a coworker or someone who is a friend. They know which style to use, and they turn it on and off. Which for me, I think I text everyone the same way. So that's interesting to me to think about who you're texting and then change your style.
I mean, I think it's just like anything else. And I think as long as there's that awareness, right, you can choose. And I sometimes will have people say, well, you know, I'm just not comfortable texting that way. And it's like, that's totally fine, but wouldn't it be interesting to have that conversation? And maybe it means we still text the way we text and vice versa, but we're no longer misreading sort of the intent or the signals that are going on there. But I thought it was really interesting that on both sides, you know, the emojis are, we're getting pushed back as not professional, and the periods are being read as passive aggressive. Like, what a fascinating thing. And then if we're missing that, what else are we missing, right? Those are pretty surface level type issues. And you know, I'm always fascinated in my work at how often maybe we think we're having the same conversation with someone who's significantly older or younger, but our lens of reference, or the way we're thinking about it could just be entirely different. So there's so much interesting context to dig into there for sure.
Well, just to end, is there any way we can avoid conflicts that arrive through texting? Is it just more being aware? Maybe being aware that someone could interpret your, if you write back, sure, like with a period, that they could be like, oh, you're mad at me, right? That kind of thing. Just
You know,
being aware.
yeah, I think for me, the easiest thing is, like, you know, anybody listening, sending out a text that said, I just heard this fascinating thing on Amy's radio show. Like, is this true? Talk to me about this. Because then that door remains open. So the other day I was texting a colleague of mine who's like in his late 20s, and I said, ha. He's like, I think you mean ha ha. And I'm like, what do you, why, how is that different? He's like, ha is sort of assertive and aggressive. Ha ha means you think it's funny. And like, we now have this open door where I can be like, fascinating. Okay, that I did not know that. Or I can say, like, that's a lot of laughing, crying emojis for one text. You know, like, we're keeping the door open. We're not taking it personally, but I think it's awareness. And then just that, like, hey, I heard this really interesting thing on NPR. Is this true? Whether people are sending it to their kids or their boss or their team members, like, then you start looking for what else you didn't see before. And to me, that's the best thing. It's not saying it's right or wrong to text a certain way. I would never say that, but it is just the awareness that we might be getting some wires crossed.
Well, thank you to Miami University professor Megan Gerhardt, who teaches management and leadership at the Farmer School of Business in Oxford. She's also the author of Gentelligence, A Revolutionary Approach to Leading an Intergenerational Workforce. Megan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to hear more about some legal issues for Meta. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. It seems like Facebook and parent company Meta are always in the news when it comes to legal issues. Accused of crushing competition through illegal monopolies, addicting children to social media, harming young people's mental health, and compromising data privacy, to name a few. Founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg finds himself in front of a judge once again, facing down an antitrust lawsuit, potentially splitting up the trillion-dollar company. Will Zuckerberg have to say goodbye to Instagram? Joining us now is Stephen Levy, editor-at-large for Wired and author of several books, including Facebook, The Inside Story. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Stephen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So starting off, can you give us a brief update on the most recent lawsuit against Meta and Facebook? What are they facing right now?
Sure. This is a lawsuit filed by the Federal Trade Commission back in 2020, actually. You know, it took this long to get it to court. And essentially, it's charging that Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, acquired a monopoly and is illegally using that monopoly to dominate the market in social networking.
So Facebook acquired Instagram in 2012 for $1 billion, and then it bought WhatsApp in 2014 for $19 billion. So they're saying that this is the monopoly by owning Instagram and WhatsApp both. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. By owning that and then using its power to further neutralize potential competitors, most prominently Snap. When it tried to buy Snap and Snap refused, it came out with its own product. It didn't have to be successful, but they put pressure on them, and eventually they did take one of Snap's most popular features and put it into their product, which had the benefit of monopoly, and they did very well with it. So it's a pattern of behavior that the FTC says is an abusive monopoly, and they will ask for remedies, presumably breaking up the company.
Now, a key issue is whether CEO Mark Zuckerberg bought the company as a part of what is being called the buy or bury strategy. So what did he say about that under oath? Was he trying to buy them instead of burying them?
Well, as you might expect, he didn't give a full-throated endorsement of the buy or bury strategy. But his behavior, and I found this, when I really dug into this in writing my book, was very much... can be described as that. He bought these two companies that you mentioned that he saw as threats. There's an email trail talking about, he's worrying about Instagram, and we said we should neutralize this. They saw the rise of WhatsApp, and they thought that this could be a social network that threatened them. And then they would look at other startups across the web and say, gee, this could be a threat to us. Let's try to buy it. If they don't buy it, let's come up with a similar product. And so I think the buy or bury strategy pretty fairly describes what they did. There's some good legal arguments on the other side. The whole thing really hinges on an argument of what Meta's market is. Is it a social network now, or is it something more? And when Zuckerberg went on the stand, he said, well, we're a social network, of course, but we're also an entertainment and discovery company. So a lot of what happens when you go to Facebook or Instagram now is not to see posts by your friends and family, but to see posts by people you never know, and companies and you never know, publications that hardly exist except in Meta posts and Facebook posts. And he said, that's our market. So we're competing with TikTok, really, as much as we're competing with any other social network.
Yeah, this idea of being an entertainment and discovery company, do you think that is, rather than being a social media company, do you think that's going to work? Is that the best defense he can take here?
Well, there's something to it, because this is where the action is on Instagram and Facebook now. You go to Instagram and you still probably see some things from your friends, but really the platform is dominated by influencers, say, and viral stuff. And they have a product called Reels, which is pretty much stolen the idea from TikTok. It's their version of TikTok. And that's proved to be pretty popular, because they built up the audience they had when they were building up Instagram and merging it with some of their capabilities that they had built up with Facebook. So it really depends on the way the judge who's going to decide this case views the definition of what their market is.
Well, and I find it interesting that this is the defense he's taken, because I would argue that he made it this way. I want to go on Facebook and Instagram and see what my friends are doing, and I have to hunt for it. His algorithm has made it so that I don't see that anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote about in my column last week, that Meta itself downgraded. They didn't invest in what really was their core business. Came up with, I discovered while doing this column, something I hadn't even known, that last month they introduced a tab on Facebook that allowed you to change your news feed to only posts put up by your friends. right?
I didn't know that. Where's that at? Yeah.
It's buried in there.
Okay.
They'll put out a press release. They didn't like make a big announcement. You think they make a big deal of it. But when you put up this tab, you only see posts by your friends. All the other garbage and slop and clickbait you see isn't there. It's just stuff by your friends. Now, the problem is that you may have 1,000 friends, 2,000 friends, but probably by now they've given up posting to Facebook because they learned that their stuff was buried.
Yeah. As soon as we're done with this interview, I'm going to go try to find that tab, and I bet it'll be hard to find, right?
It's under the friends tab.
All right. I'll look it up. But if you were to place bets, though, I mean, not that you can predict the future, but how do you think this antitrust suit is going to end? Will there be a settlement, or is Zuckerberg going to fight it as much as he can?
Well, there's one theory that Donald Trump is going to swoop in and tell the FTC, which he controls, hey, pull the plug on this lawsuit. Zuckerberg has been cozying up to Donald Trump. So far, he hasn't seen the payoff. There's two big things he could potentially want from Trump. One is to end this lawsuit, and the other is to put pressure on the European Union not to go ahead with its litigation against Meta. So we'll see. Maybe, like a lot of other places, there'll be promises to help out the things that, the causes that Donald Trump cares about, and this thing could go away. That's a possibility.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Stephen Levy, editor-at-large for Wired and author of the book Facebook, The Inside Story. Now, you mentioned Mark Zuckerberg cozying up to the Trump administrations. The New York Times reported that Mark Zuckerberg bought a $23 million home in Washington, D.C. So it looks like he's trying to set down some roots in the nation's capital. What do you make of Zuckerberg and other social media owners aligning in that power shift in D.C.?
For Zuckerberg in particular, it's sort of a mind-blowing thing. When I was doing my book, I had about 9 interviews with him, in the space of, 2.5 years. And I remember he had to go to Washington to testify before Congress. And man, he dreaded this. I mean, Washington's the last place the guy would ever want to be. Here he is buying a house there. He's very happy. He spends a lot of time in Hawaii. And believe me, I think he's going to have a lot more fun in his, island in Hawaii, than he's going to have in the mansion he builds in Washington.
And you had all these interviews with him. What is your take on this idea of his changing his company from a friending company, I guess, for lack of a better word, where it's all about friends, to being an entertainment company?
Well, it's interesting. I think what Meta wants us to believe, and Zuckerberg said this on the stand, is that, well, we notice that people are using messaging more to be in touch with friends and family. So we just kind of went that way. But the government, the FTC, is arguing, and I think it's credible, that, that shift came because Facebook was so inhospitable to friend content, like you found. So it wasn't a question of messaging is the best way to keep in contact with your friends and family. In a way, it's kind of clunky. The message goes away. You can't reference it. You can't share it, with other relatives or friends. So I think they made that situation happen. And a lot of people just had a view of the platform itself being so toxic because it relied on these viral things. And then they loaded up ads. Another big point the government is making is because the market share is so huge for Meta, we're talking about 85% of time spent on social network is, on Meta properties, that they could just throw ads on and not worry about some other social network with fewer ads drawing people away.
Another consideration when it comes to the entertainment, though, is misinformation, a big problem for Facebook that it's had for many years. Is Meta still committed at all to battling misinformation, or is that just not a part of entertainment? What's its current strategy when it comes to fake posts, I guess?
Yeah, when I was doing the book, which came out in 2020, they were grappling with it. It was a problem that they felt impelled to take responsibility for. And I think what's happened in the last year is they said, you know what, we're not going to be responsible for this. You know, let people decide, you know, if, we'll let people, you know, if they see misinformation, you know, put up a, what's called a community note and saying, hey, that's a lie. And then people will figure it out for themselves. And, you know, they basically said, guess what? We don't care. The government's not interested in, you know, watching what we do about this. They call it censorship when we do content moderation. So we're going to do much less content moderation only when it's illegal content. And, you know, misinformation will take care of itself.
Hmm. Is there anything that you think a Facebook user or an Instagram user or a general American consumer should worry about the blossoming Trump-Zuckerberg relationship? What do you think that means?
Well, I think you can see on X what it means is that not only do they, in X, do they not stop misinformation, but they put a finger on the scale to, you know, promote one point of view. You know, if the best example is, you know, Elon Musk posts get thrown at you, whether you want them or not. There was a report recently on Facebook that Heather Cox Richardson, who is a historian, very popular, and she comes from the left side of the political spectrum, that her posts weren't being distributed. That, you know, and I didn't check this out to see what happened, but people were reporting that they didn't see her stuff, and, you know, maybe that was blocked. And I don't know if that happened again, but there's the possibility it could happen. It's not illegal for Meta to do that, so that could be another way that people could be worried about what they see could be affected by even worse than a laissez-faire approach, an approach where they're trying to, you know, push a certain point of view.
And the former FTC chair who advanced this case that we're talking about right now during the Biden administration, she said on CNN last week, or maybe it was yesterday, I don't even know, that that a president meddling in this case is a constant worry and we all need to stay very vigilant about it. So do you think that the president has a place in saying something to the Federal Trade Commission? I mean, it is a federal agency.
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, he fired, you know, the FTC has five commissioners, and there's, you know, the tradition is that three are of the president's party and two are on the opposing party. And Donald Trump said, you know what, I don't like those odds. That's not even good enough for me. So I'm going to fire the two Democrats on the, you know, the commission, the FTC commission, the five, two commissioners. And there's a lawsuit about that, whether that's legal or not. But he's made it clear that, you know, what the FTC does is going to be at his command. And the guy in charge now, Brendan Carr, is, you know, actually meddling with content, you know, once the punished places that do things, you know, on their airwaves that he doesn't like, you know, for instance, editing an interview with Kamala Harris that's not to his liking.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and no matter the results of this case, I mean, something will change. Do you think that it's going to restructure how Meta looks at the future? Because there has to be, just the way Meta works as a company, there has to be things that Mark Zuckerberg was looking at buying or looking at doing. And I mean, he always has to be 10 steps ahead looking toward the future. So will this case change the structure of Meta?
Well, I think at this point, it's a long shot. If I were to bet, I would say that we're not going to see Meta broken up. But we never know. You know, the judge in this case is the same judge who's standing up against the administration on, you know, immigrating, you know, grabbing people off the streets and sending them to Venezuela. So, you know, he's not necessarily a friend of the administration. I think that if we see a relaxation of, you know, M&A enforcement, merger and acquisition enforcement, where big companies like Meta can buy potential competitors and the government's going to sit back and let that happen, then I think we will see a difference and we'll see even more consolidation. Right now, under Lina Khan, the FTC commissioner, the chair that you mentioned, she wouldn't let that happen. She wouldn't let, something come up. I remember when TikTok is still up for grads. In theory, maybe Meta could buy TikTok. Who knows?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess just to end, it seems like a court case never actually ends. So no matter what happens, someone will appeal, right?
Yeah, well, unless the case goes to Meta's favor and the FTC decides not to appeal.
Right. Well, thank you, Stephen Levy, editor at large for Wired and the author of Facebook, The Inside Story. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy. I enjoyed it.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Russell Hawley about digital deserts. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. COVID brought into sharper focus areas of the country that lack high-speed internet, known as digital deserts. President Biden made a push to expand broadband. However, Trump policies might delay some of those efforts. Joining us to talk about this and other topics is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So more than 11 million U.S. households do not have home internet, and about 1 million of those are here in Ohio. We've been trying to bridge this digital divide for years. So what's the holdup?
Well, the Biden administration had a large, broad, kind of initiative that it called BEAD, or for the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. The goal was to take $42.45 billion and use it to deliver hard landlines into areas that otherwise wouldn't have it, to bring broadband services to communities that wouldn't have it, because the most expensive part of getting broadband internet to any rural area is the cost of actually laying the wires. It is incredibly expensive. It is something that requires quite specialist work in order to do correctly. But it is the kind of thing that once you have done once, it lasts for quite a long time. So the goal there, instead of using other services, was to go and remove this. In the second Trump administration, there has been an effort to pull back the funds for the BEAD program in order to use them in other ways. And the problem that is causing is there are now state legislatures that are looking for less expensive alternatives to those, kind of digital divide solutions. And given the current composition of the government, one of those solutions is to use Elon Musk's Starlink as a potential solution in a couple of neighborhoods. But there are quite a few activist groups that are really opposed to this, and not because they're not fans of Elon Musk. There are actual reasons for it.
Okay. Well, yeah. So tell me about using Starlink. How does that differ from laying cable, laying fiber?
Yeah, so Starlink is a fully satellite-based service. So they send you a receiver that you place on top of your house, and then it has a wireless router that allows you to share that internet with as many different groups as possible. It is a set of hardware that can be set up relatively easily, and it can be, kind of turned on and off at will. There are definitely situations where a satellite broadband service is genuinely beneficial, especially in the era that we live in now, where the speed of the service is relatively comparable to most broadband things. Starlink, however, as a platform, is just not ready for that level of expansion. There is still, despite the platform being available for as long as it has, there are still waiting lists in most of the country in order to gain access to Starlink. So deploying to an entire neighborhood would just take a really long time from an activation perspective. And then additionally, the satellite hardware that is available for the current, Starlink platform is really great for right now. It is almost assuredly not going to be as useful in 5 years and obsolete in 10, which is very different from laying an actual fiber line into a neighborhood. That data line would last considerably longer. It would deliver high-speed data for a much longer period of time. It is, you know, something that is built to make sure that that community is sufficient for quite some time, whereas Starlink over time is just going to become more expensive because you're going to have to continually replace the hardware.
Yeah, so I guess that leads me to the natural question. Is satellite internet or fiber internet, which is the future?
I think it very much depends on where you are. I think that if you are in an area where it is genuinely prohibitively expensive to install a fiber line, say because you have to go through a mountain or because you are a community of 200 people, you know, 20 miles from the next town, you know, something like that, I can see where Starlink would be the better option. However, most rural neighborhoods that would have benefited from the BEAD program, the cost of deploying those fiber lines is not in that list, right? It's not something that is, you know, prohibitively expensive to lay those lines. The way that the program was built was to evaluate each neighborhood on a case-by-case basis and work with local state governments in order to make sure that those programs would actually be able to support having that installation done without incurring massive costs on behalf of the state.
Now, the program you called the BEAD program, Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, is that a program that you're saying the Trump administration is cutting funds to that or eliminating it?
Yes, that's correct. There have been a couple of different initiatives to pull back the BEAD program in different ways, and that's causing, you know, local governments to decide, you know, whether they want to switch to a less expensive temporary solution versus trying to deploy something that is a little more expensive but would last a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. With me is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. The next thing that we are going to talk about is we can move on to Elon Musk. Well, it's Elon Musk again, but Elon Musk's AI chatbot, Grok. It now has memory capabilities. Am I saying it right? Is it Grok or is it like Grok like Rock?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. It is in fact called Grok.
Okay.
Yeah. The, so
that's it's arguably such a weird name, but okay. Continue. Tell me about Grok.
So Grok is Twitter's AI platform. It is built directly into the service. If you log into Twitter, you can go and there is an option to prompt Grok in very much the same way that you would ChatGPT or Google's Gemini, you know, in that you make a request and it honors that request in the way that it can best see fit. This includes basic text requests for searching information or generating AI images. And in some cases, if you pay for the extra features, things like short video generation and stuff like that. But something that most AI platforms have in common right now is that each request is treated in most situations like either an isolated thing or a threaded conversation. By which I mean you can either make a single request and have that request be returned and then that, you know, that exchange is finished, or you can ask for additional information, you know, relative to a request that you've made. So you can say, you know, tell me what the weather will be in a week, and then you say, what about San Francisco? And so it'll you know, grab previous information and use it to apply to the next bit of information. What's happening here with Grok is very different because it plans to remember requests that you've made over time and try and use that to interpret your language in making future requests. The benefit here, such as it is, would allow Grok to remember local and regionalized slang for different things, which could be beneficial when making requests because you're able to speak and be spoken to in, you know, using terminology that you're familiar with. However, if you are like most people who are currently using AI to make silly images of things or, you know, take a look at see what you would look like as a cartoon character or an animated figure, all of those requests in Grok would then also be attributed to this kind of profile of you, and that could alter the way that Grok answers questions about you in the future.
So the idea of giving Grok memory is alarming some people. What are people most worried about with it? That it's just going to not understand you, or is there more to be worried about?
So, I mean, the thing that is true about anything that has memory on the internet is that it then becomes impossible to remove. So if you have done something potentially inappropriate because you were trying AI in the early days and you just assumed that it was something that was happening anonymously, that request will now follow you. This is particularly a problem in the case of, for example, political figures that are using them to make, kind of hit ads and things like that. Those requests would be logged in such a way that the people running Twitter would have open access to, because the data would then be owned entirely and accessible, by Twitter.
Has Musk's company been open about these changes? Like, if you open it up right now and use it, does it say, warning, it's going to remember everything?
The warning is not when you open Grok, but if you go into the settings for it, there is an option to toggle and turn it off. And it was something that was announced quite briefly by Musk that this was a beta feature that could be played with. But no, when you first open the app today and go to use it, there's no new warning about this feature.
Will it collect social media activity? So if even if you're not using Grok in and of itself, but you're using, I guess, X, will it know what you're doing on there?
Yes, Grok has from the beginning had access to all of the data that is currently on Twitter, which includes stuff that anyone publishes, as long as it is published publicly and not to kind of private groups or anything like that. But yes, Grok has from the beginning had access to all of Twitter.
Do you think that other, like ChatGPT and other AI companies, will insert memory in the future?
I think right now there is an effort to try and find new ways to use the information that all of these platforms already have access to, because a lot of these companies are currently in the middle of legal battles about what information they are allowed to have access to. This includes lawsuits with the New York Times and several book publishers and things like that. So there is an effort across all of these different AI platforms to find ways to make existing data more useful while they try and figure out the legality of what other data they can use to make their AI smarter.
All right. And then one final topic before we end here. As people upgrade to new devices, what happens to their old ones? It's the whole thing to sell or not to sell, to keep the device in a drawer just in case, 31% of US adults still hold on to their old devices. What would you say they should be doing with them instead?
I think it very much depends on the kind of device, but in most cases, especially if you're talking about like a smartphone or a television, we live in kind of an interesting world right now when the right to repair is something that has been quite high. So there are a lot of cases, especially if it's an old television, where you could find someone to either take it off of your hands for relatively inexpensive because they know how to fix it, or that they would be willing to fix it for you, because in most cases, televisions, once you get past the big plastic bits on the outside, there's only like three parts on the inside, so they're actually easier to replace than I think most people remember them being in the past. But even when it comes to things like laptops and video game consoles, there are often secondary uses for these technologies that I think most folks just aren't aware of. In a study that we did recently, nearly one in five US adults actually throw their tech away when they're done with it, not knowing that it could live this other use. Whereas as much as 40% have figured out that there are third-party services where you can sell your old tech, even for as little as $10 and $20, but in some cases up considerably higher than that, depending on the thing.
So old devices should not go into the regular trash, though. There's lots of reasons for that.
Yes, batteries in particular, they'll seep into the earth, even if they're thrown into quote unquote active landfills where those things are kind of being filtered through. There's still some pretty substantial risk there. There are proper disposal facilities for a lot of those things. If you're talking about older phones in particular, there are organizations like Cell Phones for Soldiers that are happy to take old tech so that they can renovate them and make sure that that veterans and people in kind of delicate housing situations still have access to communication tools. There are a lot of different ways that you can make sure that that tech has use afterwards, even if your goal isn't to sell it and make a few bucks off of it.
Now, CNET provided a sort of guide for disposing devices. What are some key takeaways from that, besides not throwing it in the landfill?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we kind of live in an interesting world where most things, it's a lot harder to remove the battery than it used to. So, you know, kind of step number one is if it is possible to remove that battery, then to try and you know, take advantage of that. You definitely want to make sure if it's something that still turns on that you have gone through and made sure that you've removed all of your personal information from it. So if you have a laptop that still has a bunch of information on there, then making sure that that information is not on there before you go and trade it in is an option, is something that is heavily recommended. If there's any opportunities to remove parts that you're planning on destroying, to you know, destroy them separately instead of in aggregate, because there is a risk of things like battery punctures and you know, spillage and stuff like that can be quite unsafe for you, especially if you're doing it in your home. Please don't smash things in your home.
Yeah.
Can't stress that enough.
Well, we have less than a minute, but I'm the type that I hold on to my phone until it is like dying a bitter death, right? So I often think whenever I get a new phone when my phone is on its last legs, would anyone really want it?
Even if you go to, there's a service called Earth 911. You can go to earth911.com and it'll actually tell you where there are local recycling areas near you that you can take tech like that to, and they will properly dispose of it for you.
All right, well, thank you. That is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thank you, Russell.
Thanks.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Many political scientists are alarmed by the changes President Trump has made to the U.S. government since he took office.
We're no longer living in a liberal democracy.
The United States is moving.